Lecture 2, Migration and the Anavasi.
When we look at India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh today, they are each amazingly diverse societies. A vast variety of people and cultures have come together over many centuries. Taking the long historical perspective, we can see how each culture contributed. Broadly speaking, we can identify three main origins for ancient South Asia. First, the original people, many of whose descendants are still living in the forested areas of South Asia. We'll start with this lecture devoted to the earliest humans to settle in India and their descendants. Today, over 100 million men and women in India call themselves Adivasi, meaning Aboriginal. This is the largest number of Aboriginal people in any country around the globe today. In the next lectures, we'll consider the other two major sources for ancient India, the urban-based culture of the Indus River, and then the Sanskrit-speaking people who are best known by their sacred tradition of the Veda. But the term Adivasi is controversial in India. This word was only coined in the 1930s by advocates for the rights of forest dwellers. This name helps them claim descent from the original inhabitants of India who arrived tens of thousands of years earlier. As the descendants of these indigenous people, they argue, they have moral and legal property rights over all the land that was later taken from them by outsiders. But the government of India does not admit that these people's ancestors were in India before anyone else. So instead, the government officially uses the term tribal, which describes an isolated, forest-dwelling way of life. However, even today, the term tribal often carries the pejorative connotation of primitive. Certainly, the history of the United States shows complex relations between Native American tribes and later settlers from Europe and Africa, leading up to the so-called Indian Wars. The U.S. government created a system of reservations, legally distinct areas where an often impoverished part of American society lives today. The federal government officially recognizes 566 Native American distinct tribes with legal rights that are different from those of other Americans. So, some people still use the term tribal. But many Native Americans, Canadian First Nations, and groups in Africa and South America, among others, prefer other names for themselves as the original people in that land. Out of respect for the wishes of many of India's forest-dwelling communities, I'll identify them collectively as Adivasi. But not all forest dwellers think of themselves only as Adivasi. So I'll also use the name of their individual community, like the Kharia, when I talk about them specifically. About 30,000 years ago, Adivasis were 100% of the people living in India. Today, those officially classed as Adivasis compose only 8.6% of India's total population. This dramatic shift over a long period of time resulted from various powerful historical forces and processes. Many of these are still active today. To begin to appreciate the substantial contributions of Adivasis to India's long history, we'll use some kinds of evidence that reveal how Adivasi cultures see themselves. We'll also consider other kinds of source materials and methods used by various outsiders. But recovering and appreciating any kind of historical evidence about the earliest people who entered India and their descendants presents challenges. Adivasi languages had no script until very recently, and some to this day don't have one. So they produced no written historical records. Even now, over half of all Adivasi women and about 30% of all Adivasi men are illiterate in any language. And even these figures represent recent substantial improvements. Instead, Much of our knowledge of the past of these communities comes from the Adivasis' own oral cultural traditions, especially about their religious beliefs. Often elders still proudly teach their children and recount to their guests how God created all plants, animals, and human beings at a sacred site, often right where that specific Adivasi community still lives. This is emic history, that is, the view from within the culture. These sacred accounts speak to the close bond between that particular Adivasi community and its specific home region. These oral accounts also highlight the kinship ties that all members of that individual Adivasi community share with one another. Taking just one out of many examples of such Adivasi origin accounts, we can look at how the Kariya community recounts the creation of the world, including plants, animals, and the Kariya themselves. The Kariya are only one of hundreds of distinct Adivasi communities who still live in the forested hills of central India. This account was recorded and translated from the Kariya language by two Indian anthropologists, R.C. and S.C. Roy, who listened to the Kariya during the early 20th century. Quote, "The Kariya god Panamosor created the earth, first filled with plants and trees. Then the god fashioned two clay images, each one a man or a woman, and placed both inside a hollow banyan tree. As the milky sap of the tree dropped into their mouths, the images became animated. When they grew up and came out of the tree, they began to dwell in the caves of the hills. They knew no clothing and lived on wild fruits and roots. Soon, they were blessed with offspring. In the course of time, the race of men multiplied so much that there ensued a great scarcity of food. Men prayed to the god to provide them with some other kind of food. So he sent a violent storm, which blew the leaves of trees high up into the air, which were then transformed into different kinds of birds, according to the various sizes of the leaves. Men began to kill the smaller birds for food." Close quote. But this origin account continues that the Kariya people three times displeased God, so he tried to exterminate them with a flood, a rain of fire, and then another flood. Each time, only one family of Kariya survived. The final time, the only survivors were, quote, "one old Kariya man and his nine sons and their wives who had taken shelter in a cave. They could not find food when they emerged, but finally the nine brothers bagged a deer and cut it into nine pieces, and each took a piece for himself. But they had to find water. Each went in a different direction to search for it. Surprisingly enough, as each returned, he related an entirely different experience, for each had seen a different animal or object. One saw a bird, one a fish, another a tortoise, another salt, another a tiger, and so on. The old man, when he heard their narratives, decided that each of his nine sons should adopt for his respective clan name the object he had found." Unquote. This is an explanation by the Kariya of their origin and the reason they have nine clans today. Each Adivasi community has one or more such oral origin histories. Most highlight their particular community's shared descent from the same ancestral father and mother. These accounts often include a series of tense relationships with a forest god or gods. Sometimes, such conflicts wiped out all but a single surviving family, who again began to reproduce the community. These repeated cycles of destruction and recovery perhaps reflect the cycle of the sometimes devastating monsoon floods, forest fires, or the periodic nature of their agricultural systems. Using other kinds of evidence, in contrast, produces a different account of the origins of the Adivasi. This is the so-called eidetic history, meaning from the outside of the culture being studied. But these research methods are not always very easy to use. Because the soil in many parts of India is particularly acidic, and because of the seasonal torrential monsoon rains and high temperatures there, most organic matter tends to decompose rapidly. This makes carbon dating of ancient Advasi organic artifacts, including human skeletons, almost impossible. Therefore, besides a few shaped stone implements dating from about 4,000 years ago, we don't have a great deal of physical evidence about the material culture of the early Advasis. However, anthropologists and historians are using recent scientific technologies like DNA testing and linguistic analysis to reconstruct the history of India's earliest immigrants and their relationships to today's Advasis. India and foreign scientific teams are analyzing saliva and blood samples given by many different people living in India, including Advasis. Historical genetics often uses the Y chromosome, which is passed from father to son, in order to trace paternal ancestry. Likewise, scientists use the mitochondrial DNA passed on from a mother to her children to study matrilineage. Since we generally know the likely rate of genetic mutations, we can also reconstruct roughly when and in what order different branches of human beings diverged and intermarried. All this can enable us to trace ancient migration patterns. Linguists are analyzing the vocabulary and grammar of many distinct Advasi languages. However, only about 100 of these languages survive today, many others having died out as their speakers adopted the languages of the more dominant cultures around them. Within specific regions, such as central India or the Northeast, many of the different Advasi languages are related to each other, forming broad linguistic families like Gondi, Munda, and Tibeto-Burman. Such linguistic evidence suggests how various communities, today collectively called Advasi, migrated into India as different bands, settled in particular regions, and developed their distinct cultures there, but also interacted with each other. Such genetic and linguistic analysis strongly shows that most Advasi communities are descended from the very earliest Homo sapiens who expanded out of Africa from about 60 to 70,000 years ago. Bands of humans settled in each habitable land they encountered. But some of their descendants expanded the human range over ever further in each generation. This was in a wave-like pattern. Hence, human communities spread beyond Africa across the Arabian Peninsula. Their descendants extended the frontiers of human settlement along the warm and productive coastal lands of the northern shore of the Persian Gulf and Indian Ocean. Eventually, some of their descendants entered India. Some bands circulated around in India, and we know that there have been human communities there for at least 30,000 years, and perhaps far longer. Additionally, some of their descendants extended the range of Homo sapiens even farther into China, as well as Southeast Asia, expanding as far as Australia. Further, other groups continued to immigrate into India, both from the Northwest and also from the Northeast, leading to diverse and intermixed Advasi cultures. Those Advasi communities that remained in India found ecological niches in its diverse environment. Various communities of these earliest Indians developed locally specific hunting, fishing, and gathering economies. Although similar in their broad patterns, within these niches, each community developed its own distinctive identity. Local dyes enabled particular coloring for their clothing, for example. House designs also reflected local conditions, including how heavily the monsoon rains poured down there and the types of local trees available. India's forests provide congenial habitats for a range of distinctive edible and otherwise useful plants and animals. some of the most impressive or valued animals became the symbols of particular clans, like the bird, tortoise, and tiger, singled out in the Kariya account I mentioned earlier. Much of India was originally heavily forested, but the technologies available to Adivasis early on did not include steel axes or deep-cutting metal plowshares. However, they did develop stone, bone, and other tools. Some Adivasi communities clearly forged soft copper into ritual forms. Most Adivasi communities had mastered the sparking and use of fire for cooking and for clearing brushwood. But these tools did not enable the uprooting of large trees. So most Adivasi communities developed a type of farming to supplement their other economic activities, what many of these communities today call jhum, but which outsiders call swidden agriculture, shifting agriculture, or, more negatively, slash and burn agriculture. This means that a community will cut down and burn off the low undergrowth. Using that ash as fertilizer, they plant useful crops in and among the surviving large trees. When, after a few years, the soil there is exhausted, they shift to another region, again cutting and burning the undergrowth and farming before having to move on again. Eventually, when the first area has recovered, they can circle back to it. As long as the population density remains low enough, and the amount of forest land available remains large enough, these cycles are sufficiently extended that each swidden agriculture is sustainable. Often it's 20 years or more, about a generation, before a particular Adivasi community returns to a prior site. Perhaps only elders would remember the location of stone altars and other sacred sites, as well as the nearest fishing spots or best places to hunt or gather particular plants. Although their knowledge of the surrounding forest and its wild products such as game, medicinal plants, and foodstuffs was very rich, most Adivasi communities could not accumulate much material wealth. In part, this was because most of their lands and methods of farming and hunting were not productive enough to generate annual surpluses. And also because these Adivasi communities moved around so often. As a result, most Adivasi groups were not stratified except by age and gender. Elders held and still hold great respect. Women and men specialized in different complementary productive activities. Women often did more domestic labor, like weaving and cooking and gathering forest products, while men often went on extended hunting or raiding expeditions, including by taking cattle from the surrounding communities. Even where little kings emerged from an Adivasi community, they remained closely bonded to it. Thus, especially in contrast to much of mainstream South Asian society and many other societies around the world, on the whole, Adivasi communities were and have remained largely egalitarian. As we'll see in upcoming lectures, over many centuries, other groups migrated into India, settled there, and cleared lands that had been forests, reducing the overall area available for Adivasis. Many Adivasis and their descendants survived by mixing into the surrounding society. Often it was the most able and enterprising young men who left to find even low-wage manual labor on nearby or distant farms, in towns, and cities as these developed over the last 3,000 years in India. But this process left behind much of their separate identity and cultural traditions in order to have them assimilate. Adivasi and non-Adivasi men and women intermarried. Most of their descendants do not today identify themselves and are not identified by others as Adivasi, despite their genetic heritage. The overall trend, however, was for these other cultures to push many of the remaining Adivasi communities to the margins, out of the most productive agricultural lands and back into the hills and the remaining forests. According to the last official Indian census, about 90% of Adivasis live in rural areas, often in the most rugged and agriculturally unproductive forest land. With less land available, the migration cycles of Swidden agriculture had to be reduced, meaning that the land didn't have time to recover, and therefore produced only meager crops. As a result of these broad historical forces, Adivasis have long been a particularly impoverished population. As kingdoms were developed by India's invaders or more settled communities, their rulers often tried to control the forest dwellers, demanding taxes and obedience from them. When conflict erupted, it was often the better armed and more numerous outsiders who drove roads through the forests, or cut and burned them down, or forced away the forest communities into less productive lands. Adivasis have also long come under pressure to adopt the religious traditions brought to them by outsiders. When Hindu kings ruled the surrounding areas, some Adivasis became Hindu. When Muslim dynasties ruled large parts of India, some Adivasis converted to Islam. During British colonial rule, Christian missionaries, educators, and health workers went into Adivasi areas with the goal of both converting and aiding them. Almost a third of all Adivasi communities became Christian. Today, there are private Hindu social welfare groups that are attempting to bring Adivasis to Hinduism, the religion of the vast majority of India's population. These broad processes continue down to the present. In India, about 90% of the forests have been cut down or deeply degraded. Only about 3% are virgin forests that were never cleared. Due to natural and man-made causes, about 40% of India's total area is degraded forest or wasteland, not hospitable for either Adivasis or other people. This has put increasing pressure on Adivasis and their distinctive way of life. Much of the reforestation that has taken place has been carried out by the government or by contractors who plant monocrop trees in place of the ecologically diverse forests so essential to Adivasi life. Over many decades, the government forest department has tried to assert its authority over many of the communities still living in the forests, including by banning forest fires by Adivasis, who were just practicing their customary jhum. Further, when the Indian government creates a national park or wildlife refuge, often to protect an endangered animal species, this requires expelling Adivasis who have long been living there. Only in the last decades have such forest people received some compensation for their displacement in the form of new lands or jobs as tour guides and attendants in the park. And in 2008, finally the implementation of India's Forest Right Acts began to provide some legal protection for Adivasis. But relations between Adivasis and outsiders are not necessarily competitive or hostile. Many Adivasi communities have long provided forest produce, including plants, animals, wood, and handicrafts, to the surrounding farming communities. For example, even today, Adivasis gather dinda leaves that grow only in the forest. Outside merchants purchase them from Adivasis and then sell them to urban artisans who make handmade bidi cigarettes, which are dinda leaves rolled around bits of tobacco and sometimes spices. In exchange for gathering and providing non-timber forest products, such Adivasis historically received grain, meats, metal tools, and other products that they could not make, although they needed them. And now they receive cash payments. Both the British colonial government and also the independent government of India since 1947 recognize that Adivasis are among the least well-off of India's communities. Seeking either to protect or advance of Adivasi cultures, both governments have implemented which have often proven to be conflicting policies and programs. One goal has been to preserve Adivasi culture, particularly by protecting it against intrusions of outsiders or major changes in lifestyle. This has led to efforts designed to isolate Adivasis from integration into the surrounding economy and to recognize the special status of each individual Adivasi community. Many different Adivasi communities are included on a list or a schedule of legally designated tribals. Recognizing that some of the poorest communities in India deserved compensatory discrimination, in the 1930s, the British colonial government constructed a list of scheduled tribes. The Indian government has, over the decades since independence, expanded this list of tribals so that it includes people following an Adivasi way of life, descendants of people who had once followed an Adivasi way of life, and many other less developed communities besides Adivasis. Indeed, at present, the government of India legally recognizes 704 different scheduled tribes. But the government of India does not accept that these communities were indigenous, the original Indians. Instead, today's Indian government officially identifies these communities collectively on the basis of their social, economic, and cultural condition as, quote, suffering from extreme social, educational, and economic backwardness, on account of their primitive agricultural practices, geographical isolation, and shyness of contact with a community at large, unquote. There is even a special subgroup of particularly vulnerable tribal groups, characterized by, quote, pre-agricultural level of technology, stagnant or declining population, extremely low literacy, and subsistence level of economy, end quote. Among other legal rights, members of any of these scheduled tribes have a reservation. Now, this is very different from the American system of tribal reservations, which are areas of territory where some degree of Native American sovereignty rights are legally recognized. Instead, in India, a reservation is a reserved quota of 7.5% for members of scheduled tribes, for all places for entry into colleges, universities, and government employment, as well as seats in the national parliament. So advantageous is inclusion in this schedule for affirmative action that over the years, various other groups have campaigned hard and successfully for inclusion on the official list of scheduled tribes. Hence, the number of people legally classed as scheduled tribe has more than tripled over the last half century. In just the decade between the last two censuses, their number has risen by a quarter, from 84 million to 104 million. This far exceeds what simple population growth could generate. Rather, various communities have been newly added to the schedule, often for political reasons, and thus gain access to these reservations. On the other hand, a different set of government policies has been directed at improving the health, education, quality of life, and participation in the larger society by Adivasis, often at the cost of losing their distinct culture and way of life. Since independence, the government of India has developed its own policies for integrating Adivasis culturally, economically, and politically into the national community. For example, the central government's Ministry of Tribal Affairs has as one of its goals the teaching of literacy in Hindi, which is not an Adivasi language, but rather the official main language for the Republic of India. But each provincial government also has its own separate programs and policies toward the Adivasi living in their state. Often, this has been teaching Adivasis in that province's own language, not in Hindi, or in an Adivasi language either. So where do Adivasis live today? Well, we find about half of the official Adivasis in a band stretching across the rugged and still somewhat forested lands of central India. Adivasi activists here were successful in their demands for separate provincial governments, leading to the creation in the year 2000 of two new provinces, Jharkhand and Chhattisgarh, where the Adivasi majorities can elect people who are supposed to look after their special interests. Most of the other half of India's Adivasis live in the northeast, which is also a mountainous and forested region. Here, the distinct identities of various Adivasi communities eventually led to the creation of seven provinces. Some Adivasi activists are still demanding further separate provinces that recognize and empower their individual ethnic group with yet more state governments of their own. Timber, coal, Hydroelectric, energy, and other valuable resources are located in the mountainous or hilly lands where Adivasis have long lived. This has meant that outsiders have often exploited or fought with them. Deforestation destroys Adivasi habitat. Mines dug in these regions may employ a few Adivasis, but all too often in poorly paid and dangerous work. Further, often unregulated or underregulated mining practices lead to extensive and unhealthful pollution with little environmental protection for workers or the surrounding areas and communities. Because many Adivasis today live near fast-flowing rivers, they are often dislocated by the construction of major dams. Now, these dams are desperately needed for industrializing India, generating carbon-free hydroelectric power, and also water for irrigation. But the local Adivasis are often displaced over long distances and rarely receive the benefits of that electricity or irrigation. Many Adivasi and allied outsider human rights activists have organized protests against the displacement of Adivasis by such development projects. Indeed, many Adivasi regions are today the sites of conflict, even violent Maoist-style guerrilla revolution against the surrounding society and the Indian government. A map of ongoing insurgencies, particularly of left-wing guerrilla conflicts, would feature the same areas where Adivasi communities concentrate, the rugged and still somewhat forested lands of central India and India's mountainous and forested northeast. As we'll see in future lectures, such conflicts between Adivasis and outsiders have persisted for many centuries as various kingdoms, empires, and other governments have attempted to impose their authority and extract resources and revenues from Adivasis. So, over the many centuries that Adivasi peoples and cultures have survived in India, relations between them and the many states and settled agricultural communities around them have often been complementary, but often hostile. Many times in Indian history, there have been writings without taking into consideration the contribution of Adivasis to it. By contrast, we'll periodically consider in the following lectures how Adivasis participated in that history. In the next lecture, we'll look at the second of the main sources of ancient Indian communities and cultures, India's earliest urban-based society, which was located in the Indus River Plain on the western side of South Asia, today mostly in Pakistan. And then, in the subsequent lecture, we'll examine what came to be the dominant culture in North, Central, and later South India, known by the name of its sacred texts as the Vedic culture. While over the centuries, many other diverse people continued to immigrate into India, these three cultures, Adivasi, Indus, and Vedic, and their interactions, intermingling, and intermixing form the main basis for ancient Indian history.